Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm your host. PCMC means pop culture, man, children. I'm here with my good friend and yours, Mr. Peter Marsh. Peter, how are you?
I'm doing well, man. I noticed I've been coming on the show like a little bit more frequently right now, and I'm really enjoying it.
I'm happy to have you. Today we are talking about a movie that I gotta tell you, I typically come into these episodes with a strong reading of the film. And I do have a strong reading of today's topic, which is the 2001 movie Vanilla Sky. But I think I'm not sure whether or not I like it or not, which is
Okay.
rare for me because I don't know. I think my feelings on the movie are very tinged by my emotional history with it.
Oh, okay. Like when you first saw it in what, 2001, right?
One, yeah. But before we get to that, I wanna the last time you're on, we didn't have time to ask you were too busy talking about Matt Damon. So I didn't have time to ask you about your channels. Tell us a little bit about your
Blastercast.
The LasserCast and Comic Books Transformed.
I think like two episodes ago when I was on here, I was like, oh, I've given up my YouTube channels, I've given up social media, I'm gonna go, live in a cabin in the woods and escape all of this. But yeah, I couldn't stay away. I just love talking about movies and comic books and stuff so much. So yeah, Comic Books Transformed is back with me and my friend Brian, and the LasserCast is back with me and my friend Danny. We cover horror movies on the LasserCast and horror shows. We recently covered the entire second season of Horror's Greatest on Shudder. At the time of this recording, we just finished the last episode, which was on space horror, and that's just like my fucking jam right
Awesome.
there, right? And then on Comic Books Transformed, we were covering the show Creature Commandos, which was like the first show that was set in James Gunn's new DC universe. And I think we're going to cover Skeleton Crew next. Just do like a big review of the whole season. And then there's other shows coming up, like Invincible's coming back, and
Nice.
so yeah, just on both my channels. If you guys actually enjoy listening to me talk on here, come listen to me talk about comics on Comic Books Transformed and horror movies and streaming shows on the LasserCast.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So, Peter, today we are talking about the 2001 film Vanilla Sky,
Yes.
which is stars Tom Cruise and Penelope Cruz. It is directed by Cameron Crowe.
Yes.
And it is actually a remake of a Spanish film called Abre los Ojos, which means open
Yes.
your eyes, which came out 1997,
Right.
and also stars Penelope Cruz in the same role. What's your history with this film, if you have any at all?
Of course. I can't remember who I saw it with in 2001, because I mean, at that point, it's what, 24 years ago, right?
Wow, yeah.
And I don't even remember which month it came out. I mean, in 2001.
3 months after 9/11.
Okay, there we go. I was gonna say it kind of depends on what month it comes out in
Right.
2001, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, it's like a big demarcation. Like when I saw 2001, I was like, what month was it? Before or after?
Right. And so if it's after, it's very interesting because this movie, has this really infamous scene at the beginning in Times Square, right?
Yeah.
And so the movie's set in New York. It obviously like kind of glorifies New York. It's nightlife and it's just like the scenery of New York. So like being from New York, I think it was probably just kind of exciting after 9/11 to see that. I don't remember like if I went with my friend Ted or like if I went with a girlfriend at the time or who I was with, but I remember that it was like one of those movies like Fight Club or like American Beauty where you're like, oh my God, I'm so deep liking a movie.
Yeah.
I'm liking a movie like this, like only I could appreciate something like this,
Yes.
I think it didn't really get as strong a reception as you would expect a movie with Tom Cruise and with this kind of deep subject matter getting at the time it came out.
Nope.
Yeah.
I currently it has 42% on Rotten Tomatoes
Wow. Okay.
and 72% audience rating. This movie was made almost in tandem with Cameron Crowe's previous movie before it, which was Almost Famous. It's the same crew, it's some of the same cast. He kind of made them back to back. And that movie's become like a classic. Like there was a Broadway show based on it. And this movie is sort of, I think, forgotten except for like the people that were around at the time that it had an effect on. Yeah, I was, yeah.
No, I was gonna say, Cameron Crowe, I haven't seen all of his movies, but of course I've seen like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and I've seen Jerry Maguire and this. I think maybe
Yeah.
I've seen like one other movie by him, but I know he has more than this. And I know that like he is based on the character in Almost Famous is based on him, right? Like he was like a
Yes.
journalist. And he was like covering music in like I guess the
Right.
70s or 80s or
Right.
whatever. And so obviously like music is a very important part of his filmmaking. Like
Yeah.
it's involving process. And I remember that this movie had songs in it that when you would see them and you'd see the imagery paired up with it, it kind of felt like, oh, this is something different or this is something more, particularly the end of the movie
I agree.
where
Yeah.
you're like, oh, this is kind of new for the time, you
Yeah.
know?
I think his use of music is great. Cameron Crowe, yeah, he like everything you said. He also Fast Times at Ridgemont High was based on a sort of new journalism novel he wrote because he did go undercover as an adult. He looked young, so he went into a high school and like pretended to be a high school student. There's a movie later on with Drew Barrymore called Never Been Kissed, which is slightly based on what he did. But then he did Almost Famous. Not sorry, I'm he did do Almost Famous, but I'm thinking of he did Say Anything, which is famous for the scene where like John Cusack holds the boombox above his head and it's playing Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes. And there's Peter Gabriel songs in this too, Salisbury Hill. He's good, Jerry Maguire. I think he singles. I think it's been a while since he's done anything really good, but he was sort of known for making these sort of dramedies with like really good characters. And then Vanilla Sky was sort of like his nadir because after that, I think he made like Let's Buy a Zoo or whatever the fuck that movie
Ooh,
is. And
yeah.
then he did a movie called Aloha, where most of anything anyone talked about was the fact that he hired Emma Stone to play like a native Hawaiian in it. And I don't know what he's done since.
Yeah.
So
Did he
yeah.
do like a movie with like Orlando Bloom in it too in the
Oh
past
yeah,
couple of years?
Elizabethtown. Yeah, that was I think after this. That was okay. It's been a while since he's like really done anything great. But this came out when I graduated high school. I graduated high school at what, like in like 4.5 years. I did everything longer. I did high school in like 4.5 years. I did my undergraduate in like 5 years or 5.5 years. And then my graduate degree I did in like 3 years, where I could have done it maybe in like two. So everything I've achieved, I've done. I've taken longer to do than a regular person does. But
So
yeah.
are you a adulthood delayer then? Is that the idea?
I think I'm an underachieving achiever. Something like that. I take my own time. Well, in high school, I think I was very depressed at the beginning of. I mean, I've had depression my whole life. But I didn't have any handle on it. So I was very depressed at the beginning. So, like, my freshman year and sophomore year, I cut a lot. And I don't even know if kids say that term anymore, but it means just don't go to school. By the time, like, I did start becoming a better student, I was just behind. You just, like, you wasted a few years.
And it's
Yeah.
funny because like, you and I have a lot in common. I think that's why we're friends now, even though we're like in our 40s at this point, you know. And I cut a lot too when I was in high school. And I was actually kind of depressed too, or I had like a lot of anxiety back then. I still do now too.
I think, no, actually, you know what it is? I think this movie came out, and when I was younger, I was very lovelorn. You know, like I would have like these big, massive, painful crushes on girls, and I would think it was love. Because when you're young, you know, you think that big feelings, you're like, this must be love. And you know, and I just I for whatever reason, I didn't have a girlfriend. Now you know, when I was younger, I probably felt like, oh, no one likes me or I'm not attractive enough. Now I think I probably just didn't approach it right or whatever. I probably could have if I had just like been more like less in my own head about it. I think the thing that me and my friends, because this was like one of those weird things where it's like it was like a cult hit for a small little cult. Like me and my friends at the time, especially my friend Katie, who I had a massive crush on, and my friend Joe, who's passed away. This was huge to us, and we would quote it and we'd watch it constantly. We watch. I've seen this movie with the audio commentary from the director so many times that I remember the audio commentary as much as I remember the movie. And the whole thing of like David Ames's like falling in love and then it not working out, I think that's what most like I connected to, just that like tragic heartbreak of it.
You know, it's so funny, Mike, and that's why I love coming on your show, because we can have these kind of conversations about movies and stuff, you know, versus just going over the plot and shit. I bet there's people that listen to your show that are like, oh God, it's that guy fucking Pete. They're gonna have this like really serious conversation. They're probably gonna talk about The Last Jedi at some point. But like what you just talked about is like such an important thing to me too, because I know exactly what the fuck you're talking about. Like I remember like being in my late teens and early 20s, it was just like all that fucking mattered was just having a girlfriend, and then the girlfriend had to like love you like you were the best fucking man on earth. Oh, we have to be together because this is romance. And you see certain movies when you're in that phase and you're like, this is what it's about. Like, this is, it's all about this like romance. And oh, there's some difficulty getting together, but then when you get with this person, you're gonna have all these stories about your love, you know? And this movie, it, like, I think that is something that maybe Cameron Crowe kind of excels at. Just with his filmmaking, it's kind of funny too, because like by him doing Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Say Anything, I think it kind of also like makes it feel like he's sort of like John Hughes, or like he's in that sort of, you know. But obviously, like John Hughes passed away, and John Hughes, his career kind of went in a certain direction. But I think that Cameron Crowe is like a little bit more pretentious, you know, than John Hughes,
I agree.
especially when you see the dialogue in this movie. And I think that just like, when you're like a fucking teenager, or I guess we would have been like 19 or 20 when this came out, like this movie is just like made for people like what you just described.
Absolutely. When there's a song at the end of this movie by a band called Spiritualized, called "Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space," which is in the film, it's being played at the end where like the tech support guy is, and we'll get a spoiler if you don't know the movie, we're gonna spoil the whole movie. The tech support guy is explaining to Tom Cruise's character like his funeral, and like the girl that he loved came to his funeral, and it's just this very emotional song. And about what, 6 years ago, my friend Joe, who I watch this movie with a lot, he passed away. You know, I don't know, I could cry at like a movie or whatever, but like in real life, I'm not quick to cry, but I wanted to cry because like I was sort of so shocked by learning that my friend, who was a few years younger than me, died so young. I mean, his 30s. And I just remembered, I was just thinking about all, so like the way that I accessed my feelings was I thought about all the movies and stuff me and him would watch together. So I played this song. I like listened to the song like on a loop, and I just like cried. And still like I can't hear the song without thinking about him. That's what I said in the beginning. I don't know how I feel about this movie, because the truth is like my intellect as someone who can read a film is present, but at the same time, I have so much emotional attachment to the film, and maybe not attachment, but emotional dealings with the film.
Yeah.
It's hard to read it any other way, and I think that's fine. I think, I'm a big believer that criticism itself is like a work of art, and it's about how we engage with different texts. I love things like that. Like, I love there's a writer named Rax King who writes criticism, but she also, like, her criticism is always embedded in like personal essays about her life. Like, I love shit like that. And I guess that's what kind of what this is for me, because it's hard for me to just, like, I think if I saw Vanilla Sky today for the first time, I would probably be like, eh.
Okay, but like as in like it's sort of meh, like it's just sort of
It's well put together, but I think its ideology is, first of all, it's not as mind-blowing as it thinks it is.
Absolutely agree.
It thinks it's like really blowing your mind, and to give it some credit, I think there's been a lot of movies like this since, but it's not blowing your mind as much as it does. And the love story, it's so funny because that's the thing that I connected to as a kid. The love story that I thought was like the deepest thing in the world, I look at it now, and I've watched it twice in this last week. I'm like, there's nothing there. Like, she's sort of a manic pixie dream girl. We don't know much about her except she's very, very pretty. She's has a quirky way of communicating. Like, she says weird things like, I'll tell you in another life when we're both cats. And isn't that charming? And all they have no real connection. Like, all they do is they hang out like basically once and just quip at each other, and it's just like an extended meet cute. And there's nothing there. There's very little really there. And I was like, wow, this is what I thought was like the love story of the ages. Like, there's nothing there.
I'm really, really glad you brought that up because there's so much of a difference in the way that our culture is now than there was in 2001. And the way that people would pick this apart, like on social media, the way that they would talk about Penelope Cruz's character if they saw this, or Tom Cruise's character. Or Cameron Diaz's character, they would just like pick it apart and they talk about like how he's like so persistent in the beginning with Penelope Cruz and he takes her from her friend. Like they would talk about like all this like toxic stuff about Tom Cruise. And of course, like I think Tom Cruise, we kind of viewed him in a different way when this movie came out too. This was like sort of before the Katie Holmes stuff, if I remember correctly. And it was before like all the Scientology stuff, and so we viewed him in a different way at that time too. But it's just like the you said manic pixie dream girl, right? Like I think you even said fantasy wish fulfillment. It is that like you can kind of feel like Cameron Crowe was like, oh man, this would be the greatest night of my life if I met this amazing, beautiful Spanish woman. And this is what I would say to her. You can tell it's just like this sort of like this male fantasy that it
It's also something very othered about her. Like, if she didn't have an accent, I feel like her accent, which is obviously her actual accent, but her accent is doing a lot of the work in making her seem exotic to the main character.
Yes.
And that's not her fault as an actress. That's the fault of the film. I think besides all that, the other thing that stands out now is that the main character is a rich asshole and who doesn't appreciate the life he has and treats other people like shit. And as a kid, I have to say, I completely saw Cameron Diaz's character as a villain, but in fact, I mean, she shouldn't kill anybody, but I feel such sympathy for her now. He is so terrible to her.
Yes, it's funny because Tom Cruise, I would say Tom Cruise is a fantastic actor. However, there's that cliche thing where you're like, oh, this person just plays themselves in every movie, right? And so it's not like he can really fall or become this different character, the way like Christian Bale could, or Gary Oldman, right? He just kind of plays Tom Cruise, right? Whether it's Mission Impossible or, you know, The Firm, or I don't know, some other random movie with him, or this, right? And so he is like just such a spoiled, rich Nepo baby character in this. But because he's Tom Cruise, even when he's the most obnoxious, you're sitting there being like, well, but he's Tom Cruise though, right? So like at the end, he's gonna kind of learn the error of his ways. Like you have that just subconsciously in your mind. Like he's gonna redeem himself, you know. Whereas like if you didn't know Tom Cruise and you're watching this for the first time, you'd just be like, man, this guy, he's so fucking full of himself and so obnoxious, you know.
And the way that he sees himself as the main character in life, even though really he's mistreating people, that's what's hard to get behind now. And I have to say, to criticize the film, I don't think the film interrogates that very much. I think the film even makes Cameron Diaz's character as a boogeyman. So I want to get into the plot. The film is about a wealthy guy named David Ames. His father and mother were like New York publishing royalty, like huge company, like these magnates ran magazines and book publishing and everything and this whole empire. And his father was like this great worldly guy who like people loved, and like his father wrote an autobiography where he only mentioned him in one line, which comes up later. And then his parents die in a car accident, and he's given in his like 20s 51% control of this giant company, and the other 49 is given to this board of directors that he sees as like these enemies. But he, you know, when we meet him in the film, he's like, he gets up in the morning and he's in bed with Cameron Diaz, who he's obviously had sex with, but she really seems to be enamored with him and he kind of is blowing her off. He's supposed to be going to a meeting, but he blows it off to go play racquetball with his friend, played by Jason Lee, who is an author. And they make a point that like he works for him. He's just sort of like childish. Like you think about like me in my life now in my 40s, like I think like if I had this type of opportunity, I'd take it so seriously. The fact that he like strolls into work late and stuff, and it's like it's just very annoying.
So there's like shorthand in movies, and I'm sure you can say this in better detail than me, but like where you see like a certain sequence, and it's usually done almost like a montage where a person enters an office, and then the way they react to all the people in the office kind of shows like A, how busy they are, or B, how sort of like carefree they are. Like especially in movies that involve like romance or like their rom-coms, we have someone come into an office and everyone's coming up to them and they're like, what should we do about this? What should we do about this? And then they just give kind of brief answers, or you know, and so it goes in multiple ways. And one of the ways could be that like they're just sort of overwhelmed and they have to get away. Another way is that like they're so good at their job, they can easily tell people how to do everything. In this case, the way they use that kind of sequence is to just show that he has so much power. So many people need him for their money, but yet he's just like kind of like, oh, do whatever you want. And I wonder, out of all the different types of people that can work in an office like this and have this kind of job or this kind of life, like is his maybe the most obnoxious? Where like there's people like you know, he has like this like secretary that comes up to him, and of course she's like this beautiful woman. And she's like asking him what to do about something, and he's just kind of like, oh, just do it this way. And you know, they make a point at one point where they say like these people, their lives depend on you. I think Penelope Cruz says something like
Yeah,
that at one
everyone,
point.
she's at his birthday party. She says, everyone at that party is dependent on you for their survival.
And I think that like you know, in 2001, we might not have been concerned about like class and you know. The difference between like the wealthy class and the working class and stuff. But nowadays we fucking hate billionaires. Like we want to just fucking Marie Antoinette all of them, right? And so to see him just kind of be like, oh, whatever you want to do, you know, I think it's kind of infuriating.
Because it's this character, the way this character acts in the movie is what Elon Musk thinks he is. He's
Thank
not,
you.
because he's a big nerd who's never achieved anything. But like, this is like obviously the fantasy Elon Musk has in his head of himself.
Exactly,
David Ames
exactly.
absolutely would have like given money to Trump and like been at the inauguration.
But he would have been like hitting on like Melania or something,
Yes,
and
right.
you know,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, that is absolutely a trope that you're talking about. Like, yeah, because he goes, he gets to, and also it shows how powerful he is. Like, he gets his car, brings him to work, and outside on his assistant's waiting for him, but outside on the sidewalk is like a what do you call it? Room service kind of cart with food. Like, and she's like, "Have you had breakfast? There's food for you if you want." And he doesn't want the breakfast, and she's like rushing him into a meeting. He's wearing a stupid hat,
Right.
and it's this idea of like this guy has everything, and he doesn't take it seriously.
Right.
So he has a birthday party. There's this framing a structure where we see that Tom Cruise's character is wearing like this weird like mask, and he's in prison, and his prison guard is what's his name?
Oh,
General
Michael Shannon.
Zod, Michael
Michael Shannon.
Shannon. very early Michael Shannon role, and his prison psychologist or psychiatrist is Kurt Russell. And he's interviewing him about a murder. So you're like, okay, what happened? That's the sort of like framing device. And we see he has his birthday party, and Steven Spielberg is there in a cameo.
Right.
And he's got like this it just shows us like there's a lot of, and I think I probably, sadly, I have to say I probably really reacted to this when I was young. There's a lot of like wealth porn, I think. Like, oh, look how cool this house is and stuff.
Yep.
Actually, did you notice that he lives in the Dakota?
I did notice that. Yes.
He
I
lives in the
mean,
Dakota. Yeah. The
you know, good.
Dakota is a famous building that John Lennon lived in, and he actually was killed outside of. And also the movie Rosemary's Baby, she lives in the Dakota.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure there's some significance to that. I mean, this movie, one of the things that's really interesting about it is that they use imagery, which I'm assuming like maybe there's images from like Tom Cruise's actual life, like his childhood and stuff. Like
Yeah.
I know that at the very end there's like a shot of like him in some water with like his mom, and I'm thinking that's actually Tom Cruise and his mother from like a childhood picture. And they do that with Penelope Cruz too, where there's just kind of like these flashes of imagery. And I know that like going along with the idea of the plot and stuff, and the idea that like this is all constructed by him, that they're kind of showing like this is where they drew this part of the movie from this picture, from this image. And it's like footage from like a person's life, which it could literally be Tom Cruise's life. Then there's just like footage from like movies and like TV shows and commercials just thrown in there, you know. And so that to me is very interesting of like, this is what kind of makes a person, this is what kind of makes a person's reality, is like these personal experiences and then these like pop culture random things or historical things, you know.
Absolutely. I think that is the stuff that really works for me, because it has a lot of references to popular culture and literature and film and stuff, but not in the sort of strictly postmodern way that I think we still see, or that we definitely were thinking about at the time the film came out. It's more personal than that. It's this idea of like somehow this stuff is who you are, which I think is very, very interesting, and sort of in my own ethos about life. Like at the end, he is deciding, like we'll get to it, but like he's basically in a virtual reality. And then he's deciding that he wants to wake up, and he'll be in the future, and the girl that he loved will be dead, but he'll be actually in life. And there, his he has a fear of heights, which they establish pretty clunkily early on. And he has to jump off this building as his final challenge to wake himself up. And so there's this like montage of images, like you were just talking about, and there's like an image of like a baby with her mother, which is like, whether it really is him or not, or maybe it's the director's life, who knows?
Right.
It's you feel like, okay, that's somebody's real memory. But also like there's an image of Eloise, the children's book about the little girl who lives in the Plaza Hotel, and then like album covers, and like you see like fucking a rock star like sliding on a stage along with images of like a regular person's life, and I think that stuff works so well. I don't know. I really l that is the stuff that I still find evocative.
Yes, I agree. And it's funny because like that is what makes him David Ames. That's what makes it seem like he has more to him than all this superficial bullshit that we see.
Yeah.
And I think that like, going back to what you were talking about with like the framing device and how he's wearing this mask and it seems like he's in some sort of like high security prison. I do kind of like about the movie that he talks about, we get this narration about his life when he's like this arrogant prick and all this stuff's going on. I do like that it's like it's in the past and that something tragic has happened,
Yeah.
and I like that like his commentary is like very cynical about this world that he's in, because it'd
Yeah.
be kind of almost too much without that cynical commentary.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And then just to kind of just keep going about the party and stuff like that, I did just a bare minimum research when I was looking up this movie recently, and they were talking about how this movie's influenced by this like quote by Elvis, where like he says that he could feel like alone in a room, in a crowded room.
Interesting, yeah.
And then there was some other song that like was a big inspiration for this. And it's like a melancholy kind of song, and it's about loneliness. And like I think what informs the audience that it's not like having an impact on him or this party's not valuable to him is that it has this cynical commentary from when he's in the present day, right?
Right.
But there isn't any kind of scene where like he's just kind of like in the bathroom by himself and he's like looking at himself in the mirror, kind of like, oh, I can't believe how fake I am. You know what I'm
Right,
saying?
right, right.
Th
No,
there's
yeah.
nothing like that. And I think I don't know if you wanted to like kind of focus on this later on, but I mean the very first scene of the movie is like the embodiment of loneliness.
Yeah. No, like let's talk about that.
So I mean like he we have this sequence, we keep talking about the sequence where he's at this party, Steven Spielberg's there, there's a fucking like Star Wars blue hologram playing like jazz in this party, but the very first scene of the movie is just David Ames completely by himself
Yeah.
and maybe in one of the most famous places in the world for being crowded and
Yeah.
it's completely deserted, right?
Yeah, he's in Times Square. He leaves his apartment. He will for he hears it begins with we hear the words Abre los ojos, and it's coming from Penelope Cruz, by the way, who he has
Right.
not met yet. So there's theories around that, which we can get into later. But then he gets up, he gets dressed, he goes out. He sees there's no one on the street, and he's kind of like, this is weird. And as he keeps driving, there's no one there. And then he comes to Times Square, and he gets out, and he just leaves his car in the middle of the street, and there's no one anywhere. And he starts running down the street, screaming and stuff. And on that big screen that you see in Times Square, they're playing the pilot episode of The Twilight Zone, which is called Where Is Everybody, which is an episode about someone who wakes up and is completely alone. And Times Square has all of like these, ticker tapes and LEDs and advertisements. But if you look, there's also like weird shit that like isn't really technology that we had at the time. And this, I think this is more impressive in 2001, because now I think you could easily fake this, or you could do it on, you could just do it with CG. But they actually did this. They filmed it. It was like they had like some crazy short amount of time to do this one shot. They were like, you have like an hour to do it. And it was like 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock, whatever, on like a Sunday morning, that they had to, they kept people away. But they really did it. Yeah.
I mean, when you grow up in New York, stuff like this happens, right? And you get so excited when you hear about it too. I remember hearing about this
Yeah,
when it
yeah.
happened, and other examples. There's another example with Tom Cruise where it was the Steven Spielberg War of the Worlds, and they're driving on like the Staten Island Expressway,
Oh,
and I
yes,
remember
yeah.
like the expressway was kind of like shut down at certain points, so like you could see things on the expressway, and I
Yeah.
remember that and be like, oh shit. Then of course there's like Ghostbusters 2. Like we were around and conscious by that point. And I
Yeah,
remember my dad
exactly.
saying that like he saw them kind of filming that downtown or
Yeah.
whatever. It's such an exciting thing. I mean that sequence is amazing when you think that it actually was filmed like that. I mean, because
Yeah.
like you said, in modern day, they would just probably pick a time at night when Times Square is like the least active, and then they would just digitally remove everyone and then
Right.
make it daytime too.
Yeah, and now they don't film anything in New York. I mean, it's hard to film in New York. It's cost prohibitive to film in New York. You know, in the last Ghostbusters movie, they just filmed in England. They rarely do. So yeah, it's very impressive, and it is interesting. It ends up being a dream sequence. And the whole movie's about this idea of dreams, and it's he so he gets into he very much is basically mistreating Cameron Diaz's character, and he's just using her as like a fuck buddy. But she and he's I think he's aware of the fact that she likes him, but he's sort of ignoring that. And he's doing that thing the guys do where he's like, well, I told her my what I want, so she can't be mad at me. And so he has his birthday party, which he doesn't even invite her, but she comes and she like shows up in his bedroom like naked, and he's like, but he's like flirting with Penelope Cruz character who came as a date with his friend. So he's a scumbag, and he's sort of flirting with this other girl, and then he goes and has this whole meet cute like evening with Penelope Cruz, which is full of a lot of bullshit, you know. And the next day when he's leaving, he doesn't have sex with Penelope Cruz, but when he leaves her apartment feeling like elated, he feels elated. He also feels like, oh, I'm gonna take back my life. I'm gonna go to work and really try. Cameron Diaz's character comes and is like, hey, get in the car, you know, let's have sex. I won't tell anybody. And he makes this terrible decision to do it, even though he feels like he just fell in love with this other girl. And then she starts to like tell her feelings and kind of freak out, and then she drives the car over like this little overway, where you know, like bridge or whatever. And she dies, and we learn she dies in the accident, and his arm is broken and his face is messed up, and he you know, his Tom Cruise good looks that he had are gone, and he was in a coma and stuff, and that's sort of the beginning of that drama.
You know, it's funny because like when I talk about stuff on my show or I talk about stuff on here, there's always this sort of feeling of like, oh, well, you have to be politically correct and you got to make sure that you don't say certain things. And it's weird when you talk about love interests in a movie or like attractive characters in a movie because it almost feels taboo to talk about women nowadays of like they are so attractive. Like you never really see people talking about that, but I think for the context of this movie, you kind of have to talk about this because, like, just the way that they're filmed and like lit and stuff like that. Like, there's one shot of Cameron Diaz when she's in the car, waiting for Tom Cruise to come with her in the car, and she's just smiling at him. And the effect is that she has to be tempting for him to want to get in that car, right? But Cameron Cruise, Jesus, Cameron Diaz, like, she looks like a fucking vision. In that car, like the
Oh,
way
she's
she's shot,
beautiful.
exactly. It's like she's like in her physical like prime and stuff. She looks amazing, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe how good she looks there. Then there's shots with Penelope Cruz too, and you know, like there's something to be said about the filmmaking to like make attractive people like look this good, and the movie itself, whether it's focusing on people or scenery or whatever, it's a beautiful looking movie.
Yes, it's a gorgeous movie. It's a gorgeous movie. And in that, when that scene where Cameron Diaz comes up to him, I agree that she looks beautiful, but I also read menace in that because she, well, first of all, her blue eyes match the color of her car, which is beautiful. But I also there's also something very like shark-like about that moment, the way she sort of like comes up to him.
I think the way the car even enters the shot
Yeah, it's like
is kind of
Jaws or something.
menacing. Like, yeah. But you know what's funny about that whole sequence is you know things are going wrong just based on the dialogue and then like his facial reactions to what she's saying. And the thing is, I remember like, you know, so I was like probably 19 or whatever. I remember seeing this in the theater and she talks about how she's like, I swallowed your cum. And that to hear that in a theater, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe she just said that fucking line. You know, even though like as adults and stuff, we could say something like that easily, you know, but like to have it in a major Hollywood film, you're like, what? It was so scandalous, I thought, to hear that.
I know. And this is See, this is the stuff that I feel like is the stuff that ha ages the least well, because the film, it feels like the film a little bit is trying to deal with that, but not enough. Because I kept thinking, like, later on when he's in this virtual reality fantasy, he has this thing where, like, in the dream, he replaces Sophia with Cameron Diaz, so like he's sort of going crazy, and he thinks like one is the other, whatever. And I feel like the thing that they should be dealing with is his guilt. And I feel like, but is it's not there enough. Like, is he feel guilty? He should feel guilty. He seems like he treats Cameron Diaz's character like this villain who ruined his life. But it's like, you did mistreat her terribly. And he should have guilt over that.
Yes, I agree. Like the best way they could have resolved that or improved upon that was at the very end when he's on the top of the skyscraper. Like Cameron Diaz should have been there in some
Yes.
kind of capacity for him to like apologize to, like, or just to show like deep regret to, but
Right,
she's not
his
there at all. It's just
I
Penelope
know his
Cruz.
regret is that he went into the car with her, because he basically, because he agreed to have sex after he had already quote unquote fallen in love with Penelope Cruz. Like, that's the regret, not that he treated her like shit.
Because like his sin, and I think the main sin of the movie is just sort of like being greedy and arrogant. It's like, you're taking more even though you should be grateful for what you have, right? And obviously that's his problem that he deals with the whole film, right? And so he pays the price by, Tom Cruise is considered like one of the sexiest men alive at that point. And it's so funny that this movie, he looks like Two-Face for half of the movie, right?
It's Jason Lee says to him, like, Cameron Diaz's character was his dream girl, and you treat her like nothing. When I to me, she I would appreciate that relationship so much.
And I mean, like, my wife actually really loves this movie, right? And one of the first things she says when she starts reminiscing and just saying points about this movie, she says, you have to appreciate the sweet with the sour, right?
Yeah.
That's like one of the most quotable lines from this movie. Jason Lee says it at least twice in the movie. I think maybe even Tom Cruise quotes him at one
Yeah,
point
yeah.
too. There's that. There's pleasure delayer, which is another like term that
Yeah,
gets
yeah.
thrown around. And but that's the core of the movie. It's not that he mistreated a woman and she kind of had like a mental breakdown. It's not that. It's that like he was greedy and he didn't appreciate what he had, and that's why he's paying the price and he's a Batman villain for like 40% of the movie,
Well, since you brought up the sweet and the sour, when I was 18, I was like, this is the deepest thing I've ever heard in my life. Oh my God. And now I don't know if I feel that way.
It's pretty simple and basic. It's like, oh, you have to experience negative things to appreciate positive things. Yeah, we get it. And Jason Lee, it's funny because he's like Dave in all these fucking Alvin and the Chipmunk movies, and you just kind of cringe when you see him in them. You're like, oh man, how far are you fallen? But he's usually just like a supporting character in things. He's a really good fucking actor,
I agree. He brings levity to this.
Yeah, he like because this movie is great. There's great examples of like, he does that kind of quippy shit, which I think he, as an actor, he's good at that. But then there's a lot of facial reacting to like Tom Cruise and what Tom Cruise does in this movie. And there's like subtle stuff where you can tell he's like annoyed at him. There's subtle stuff where he's kind of like crushed inside. He's like, I just lost my girlfriend to Tom Cruise. Great. And I'm gonna accept it. There's like menace at one point when he thinks that Tom Cruise beat Penelope Cruise. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a range, even though he's just the supporting character.
And he looks great. He was very handsome at this point.
Yeah, he's wearing like a fucking pea coat and stuff.
He's a very romantic idea of like a writer who like drinks too much and stuff.
He has that one line where he's like, I good you, but evening, or something like that. Like, and it kind of does this thing where he looks up at the sky, like, what did I just say? It's so awesome.
Let me, this is something, so you have a YouTube channel called Comic Books Transformed. I don't know what to make of this, or maybe I'm just, this is me reading too much. All the women have superhero names. Julie Gianni and Sophia Serrano.
Yes.
I don't know what, does that mean anything, do you think? Am I just overreading that? That stuck out to me because I don't think Sophia's, if I'm remembering right, I could be wrong. In Abre Los Ojos, her name is Sophia, but that's not her last name. So he gives her a different last name. I don't know if that means anything, but that stuck out to me.
It probably is because our culture is so saturated and so obsessed with superheroes at this point that we might read it as some kind of superhero thing. However, there is that kind of comic book dynamic in this where there's two women. There's a dark-haired woman and a blonde-haired woman. So it's like
Betty and
Lois Lane,
Veronica.
Betty and Veronica, right?
Yeah.
Lois Lane and Lana Lang, right?
Yeah.
Mary Jane has red hair, but like Mary Jane and Gwen Stacy, like that
Yeah,
kind of
yeah, yeah,
thing.
yeah.
So there is that dynamic, and it might just be like kind of shorthand because it's like, oh, there's two different women and they're two different types and stuff. But to think that like so much of his experience is based on pop culture and stuff like that, I wouldn't be surprised if it is like an Archie Betty Veronica
Yeah.
thing. Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the car accident because I actually think this is one of the best car accidents in the movie. Because when you see car accidents in movies, they tend to be really bombastic and the car will flip around like 10 times and it would be crazy.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, she drives off the bridge and the car sort of nosedives and hits a wall and then very like with huge impact and then falls back. So it's sort of it's very brief, but it's sort of brutally brief. In a sort of way that I'm gonna say is realistic, even though I've never seen an accident like that. Did you feel that? Did you think it was a cool car accident
Yes,
or
yeah.
yeah.
It's very well shot. You know, the sequence is like very tight inside the car itself, and it's like their facial reactions. It's like her saying stuff, kind of manic stuff, and she's just looking ahead at the road, and then you see like his face, and he's
Yeah.
trying to be cool at first, but then he's getting more and more freaked out to the point where he's eventually screaming, and you're like so focused on that interaction, and then for it to cut to like the car just smashing like that, it's very abrupt, very jarring. I think that's what adds to the realism, is like, because that's what a car accident does, right? It's just basically like
It's
shuts everything down. Yeah, go
yeah,
ahead.
it's crazy, then it's over.
Right,
And then it's
exactly.
still, and the camera, we see the car accident from like a long shot. We're not in the car for the moment of the impact, but then
Right.
it stays on the car there for a while,
Yeah.
and it fades out, and then we sort of move to the future.
Right. You even see like a guy kind of starting to run towards them. I think you hear people in the background
Yeah,
like
yeah,
saying
yeah.
stuff. Yeah. It's very effective. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that it's great examples of filmmaking, right? I mean, that's
Yeah.
just one example of it. I mean, what I said before about the love interest being so beautiful, so alluring, that's great filmmaking. Then there's like kind of the pretentious stuff. I think that the dialogue itself in the movie is what aged the most poorly for me.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What strikes you as 'cause I agree with you.
Yeah.
Does anything particular that strikes you as like, oof, that's not great writing?
Yeah, there's something that like I can't remember now, but like Tom Cruise says something to Jason Lee while they're driving in the car, and Jason Lee makes a joke and Tom Cruise laughs really loud, and it's just like so like arrogant and
Yeah,
just
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of lame at the same time. They like
Oh yeah,
meant.
they almost get into a car accident. And he says, "We almost died." And then Jason Lee says, "Yeah, and you know what's funny is your life passed before my eyes." And then Tom Cruise goes, "How was it?" And he's like, "Oh, almost worth dying for." And then, ha ha ha, well, it's yeah, it's lame.
It's like too much, you know. It's like too over the top, and honestly, like a lot of the stuff with Penelope Cruz and him in that like second apartment that he
Yes.
has, like, I mean, okay. If you want to show how fucking rich a guy is, show that he not only has his own awesome apartment, but then he has like a second apartment to
Yeah.
take women to and try to seduce. It's like, okay, this guy's really fucking rich if he has this in
Yeah.
Manhattan.
And that's when he
But
shows her the Monet painting. We haven't said yet. The movie is called Vanilla Sky.
yeah.
And it, I don't want to say it gets a name from, because that's not the name of the painting, but there's a Monet painting called The Seine at, I'm going to say this so badly, Argenteuil, I'm really not good with French. And,
Okay.
but I think people refer to it as Vanilla Sky. And he shows her that painting. And that's kind of where it gets the, see, something that works for this film is that it has some of this sort of existential stuff in it. Like, I remember in the audio commentary of the movie, Cameron Crowe says that when he saw the original movie, Abre Los Ojos, it made him think of like a conversation you have very late at night where like big ideas can flow easily. And I've seen Abre Los Ojos not in like 25 years, but I did see it. And from what I remember, it's the same story, but it's more of just like a thriller. A lot of like the existential stuff that we react to in this is not in Abre Los Ojos. So that stuff, I think, works, but at the same time, I don't know if it fits. I don't know. I sometimes now looking at it, I wonder if like he was trying to make a different kind of movie, but had the outline of another kind of movie, and he was trying to make it work because there's he doesn't interrogate Tom Cruise's character the way that I think the film should.
Yes. Well, I unfortunately didn't see the original film that this is based on, but I did do a little research, and they were saying that Tom Cruise was at the premiere for the original film. Open Your Eyes is like what it translates to in
Yeah.
English, right? He's at Open Your Eyes, and he wanted to basically get the rights for it so that he could work with Cameron Crowe again after Jerry Maguire. And I'm assuming that they kind of were just like infusing that kind of Jerry Maguire energy into this original film, which I know, like you said, was like a thriller,
Yeah.
more of a thriller back in the day. And so I think that like David Ames, Jerry Maguire, they're probably kind of like fusions of Tom Cruise and Cameron Crowe, like sort of like fantasy wish fulfillment stuff with Cameron Crowe, and then like just Tom Cruise's personality and maybe even Tom Cruise's life a little bit, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that that's it's a jarring combination. It's not peanut butter and jelly to take this sort of like,
Yeah.
thriller, like this kind of romantic thriller with like two women and stuff that's Spanish, and then like melding it with this sort of like pop culture reference existential,
Right, yeah. It's an uneasy fit.
right, exactly. But I think that like we should talk about like his life after he is disfigured and he's because
Yeah. But I want you, before we do that, I just want to give you, I have one line here that's going back to what you were saying about the dialogue. At one point, she says, "Every passing minute is another chance to turn it all around." And 18-year-old me was like, "Whoa, that's the deepest shit I've ever heard. What?" And like the sweet and sour, it's like, first of all, it's if somebody said that to you in earnest, I'd laugh at their face. I'd be like, "Dude, are you acting like you just thought of that?"
Like this is the kind of thing where you would see it as like a meme on Facebook that your aunt posted, and it'd be like
Yeah.
attached to like a minion in like a wedding dress or something.
And then all her old like friends would be commenting like, "Yes, so true."
You should have left David months ago. Like, exactly.
But yeah, go well, let's talk about after the accident.
So I'm assuming that this is the part that draws the most from the original film, because this has the most unsettling imagery, and it maybe is the most interesting imagery because it's the most dark, and it seems to kind of go in the face of Cameron Crowe, in the face of Tom Cruise. Like, it feels like it doesn't fit in with them at all. It
Yeah,
feels so
they go to a
different.
club that's very like doesn't it doesn't even I don't know, it doesn't even make sense to me that like why would that be the thing you do with in this situation?
I think that maybe like he was sort of emasculated. I mean, here's the thing, right? This is what's so interesting about this. So much of the movie is based on, oh, look how horrible this could be for Tom Cruise, this sexy, attractive man, to be ugly now. Like, this is the worst thing of all. This is
I
worse than
know,
torture.
yeah.
And so like
Yeah, he's not
it,
disfigured enough. They should
right.
really like he should like have no nose. Like I'm
Right.
not trying to be offensive, like, but like it should really be he just looks like a guy was in an accident. Like he like it should be like way worse, honestly, I think.
I'd hate to say this, but like disfigured Tom Cruise looks better than me, 42 years old. You know, I'm like, oh, I kind of wish I looked like Cruise Two-Face character, right? But no, to me, like, because that whole sequence feels it just feels like a different movie from the rest. And it's because like I think the other stuff is the Cameron Crowe stuff, and I think this is probably the Spanish movie. And I know there's like first off, I've seen it in 2001. I think I thought his face looked worse than I actually think it looks now, you know. But then there's this one shot that I was like, oh, okay, we're gonna have this club scene, we're gonna have this one shot where like he's dancing and his mask is on the back of his head, and we're gonna see his. I was like, oh, here comes that scene. And the reason why it stands out is because it's like this real shot sequence, you know? And, you know, regardless of what I'm saying about like Cameron Crowe being pretentious, Tom Cruise being obnoxious, there still is that stuff that does connect with you because you've experienced it in your life. And as like a man, especially like a man like going to clubs, dating in New York and stuff, you've absolutely been in a point where you're going to hang out with a girl that you like, and you just try too hard, and you just fucking crash and burn. And that scene really captures it in the club.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, and you drink too much.
Right.
And you know, looking back at it now, I think he fucks it up. I think if he you know, like he sees it as like he gets bent out of shape. First of all, he shouldn't have worn the mask. So they give him this mask, which is a big part of the original movie. And in the original movie, it looks more like an actual like Halloween mask, whereas in this, it looks like a sort of like silicone thing. And I think in this movie, it's he's trying Cameron Crowe's trying to homage the French movie Eyes Without a Face. And it and they're like the doctors. There's a funny scene where the doctors are like it's a facial prosthesis, and he's like, "Oh, cool," because I thought it was a fucking mask.
Right.
And but he goes with it, and then he's acting weird immediately. And but like if you look, she's like interested in talking to him. She's looking for him when he's not there. So he fucks it up entirely.
Yeah.
But it goes really badly. And at the and he even though Jason Lee didn't hook up with her, like he has these like weird like fantasies of like Jason Lee is going and meeting her and hooking up with her behind his back.
Yeah.
Which is like this weird jealousy that he's projecting because that's not true. But also, like, you were such a bad friend to Jason Lee. Like, obviously, Jason Lee liked this girl and brought her to your birthday party. I don't know.
Well, what's really interesting about this whole movie and this sequence in particular, even though he's rich, we just see it in, we don't see him be like, oh, I'm gonna rent out this restaurant or something like that, or oh, you want that here? I bought it for you. Like it's just already his possessions that he already has. Like Bruce Wayne in movies will do these sort of like random things to show his wealth, where he'll like buy a place or something, right? And then he's not very clever for most of the flashback sequences either. So really, like his strength comes from how good-looking Tom Cruise is, how in shape he is with his body. And then how like charming and quick-witted he is with his conversation. And so when the accident happens, it takes that away. He's still rich. He still has the same job. It hasn't like affected his mind, but it's just that he's not attractive, right? And so that whole sequence is basically he's been emasculated by this accident, and he's trying desperately to reclaim his manhood, reclaim his power. And he's trying too hard, and that's what's fucking the whole thing up.
And that's where I'm like, the thing he should be, it shouldn't be all about his face. Like, the thing he should be dealing with is that he mistreated this woman so much that she committed suicide and
Yeah.
tried to take him with her.
Right.
And he doesn't deal with that, really. He doesn't really deal with that. And he becomes hyper fixated on Sophia. And that's another thing that I wish them I feel like is immature. There's something immature about the movie.
Yes.
Because he really does just meet her once, they
Yeah.
vibe, She's attractive, he's attractive, they flirt, they don't really get to know each other, but they just have like an extended meet cute. And then he has this accident, and then because he met this girl before the accident, like she's the thing he's fixating on, and then they go on to hang out and it doesn't work out because he's weird. And in the real, we've learned later on, like in real life, like nothing after that, he kind of just left her alone, but became more and more sad. And he learned about this place where they'll, after you die, they'll freeze you and then they can bring you back in the future when they, I don't know, like cure death. But while you're, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. While
No.
you're dead, see, I don't know why they don't freeze you while you're alive. Like, that's the thing that would make sense. But you're supposed to be dead. But anyway, even while you're dead, they give you like this virtual reality fantasy, and you can live whatever life you want. And you can choose where they put the splice. So he chooses to put it the night after, like he falls asleep like in a ditch that night because he's super drunk. He makes that the point. And I guess we're supposed to think that's deep because that's like the sweet and sour thing. Because he could have made the splice before. He could have made the splice before he had the accident. But he made the splice after he had that really down moment, and then he has this whole fantasy where he's with her. But that's all. It's like when you're a kid and you have a crush on somebody and you build up in your head who they are, and it's not really who they are, it's just who they are in your head. Like in the end, he doesn't know her at all. And I really don't like, I loved it when I was young, but in the movie, at the end, like there's this guy who's this mysterious guy, and you're like, who is that? But you find out he's like tech support for the virtual reality. And the guy I was talking to before, I was saying this before, like we see like his funeral or his memorial that his best friend gave for him, and we see that Sophia Cruz's Penelope Cruz, sorry, Penelope Cruz's character comes to it and like pays her respects, and she's sort of like sad, and then the tech support guy's like, and she never got over that night where true love was always possible, and it's like, what?
Yeah,
Like,
how would
that
he
is
know that?
so. First of all, how would he know that? And I don't think this movie, and you could say, well, this is part of the fan, this is what he's paying for, but I don't think the movie's smart enough to be making that point. It's sort of having it both ways, and it's like, dude, like, no, like, you met someone once.
Jason Lee, that's one of the best parts of the movie is Jason Lee just says that to him. At one point when like Tom Cruise is at his lowest point and he's mad at Jason Lee and stuff, it's like, this is all about a girl that you met once, like you hung out with her one time, and the way it's delivered and the way that it's shot, like you feel the effect of it. It's kind of like, yeah, you're deluding yourself. You're obsessed with this woman that you met once. I was gonna say, because we can kind of start to go into like the virtual reality part of it too, is that when this movie came out too, it's like maybe not even 2 years after The Matrix, right? And then it's like, I think it's before the sequels to The Matrix.
I believe so.
So, like us at that age, we were like kind of craving something like that. Like, oh, tell us how reality's not real. Tell
And it
us
was
how
a
this is
big
all.
thing at the time. There was Existence. There was a lot of movies at that time about virtual reality worlds.
And I think that what's different from The Matrix and this is that like emotions and romantic life are so intertwined with like the reality in this. Like the virtual reality is so based on just romance
I
and dating
know.
and stuff versus like, robots have taken over and, we have this fake world. And so it's just so interesting that like to get out of this virtual reality and like the problems that he experiences in this virtual reality, they're all connected to women and stuff in his relationships. And I think that if we're going along this path, they do have that sort of like that period where everything's happy and nice, that things recover. They play that U2 song, Wild Honey, and it's like, oh, you can tell here comes the fun, nice part now, after the Sinister Club part. But then things start to glitch on him in this programming. And I think that like going back to what you kept talking about, where like he doesn't really he's not concerned about what's really important, the fact that he did this to Cameron Diaz. I think what would have been a fitting end for this movie, and I don't know if this happens in the Spanish movie, but like it would have been fitting if he actually killed Sophia and that's what happens. that like he lost his mind
Right.
and he thinks that she's Cameron Diaz and he kills her. That would have been like so much darker and deeper.
Well, I think that does happen in this movie, but it also the movie doesn't really deal with it. The movie doesn't really put a lot of emphasis on the fact that he's on trial for murder and all. It makes it all just a framing device.
I read that there's a fucking alternate scene in the movie that they cut where like police come into the building that he's in at the end and shoot at him and Kurt Russell,
Yeah, and
you
he
know.
shoots at them back. Yeah,
Right.
it's in the trailer and it's in the original movie too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, it gets more violent. Yeah, like we were saying, it's an uneasy he's it's like trying to remake another movie into the movie you want it to be. You know, like for here's the thing why I think it works for young people, this movie. For you to be totally behind David, you have to believe and buy into the idea that there's a such thing as love at first sight. And that you can just meet somebody and get along with them so well that like it would be the greatest love of all that would change the world. And when you're older, you're like, that's not, there's no such thing as love at first sight because love, you can only love somebody you know, and you don't know somebody when you don't know them. So love at first sight is, oh, no matter how great it might feel to you, is always physical. It's always sexual. So they want to fuck each other. So it's so that's where the movie's immature.
To completely agree. It's very superficial in that regards, you know. But there is something better about the times when he's with Penelope Cruz in the dream versus their pretentious like first meet cute, right? Like
Yeah.
one thing that I like about the first meet cute is that sequence where they're both drawing each other. And she does this sort of like a fucking boardwalk caricature of Tom Cruise, and then he does this sort of like nice picture of Penelope Cruz.
That made me so furious.
Really?
Because it's such a lame move. Imagine really doing that to a girl. Being like, hey, let's draw each other and do fun drawings. And then she does the prompt. And then you draw her looking beautiful. And you're like, ah, I couldn't make fun of you. You're so beautiful. It's like, what a lame move. What a lame, like any girl with respect for herself would be like, is this your move? You say, let's fucking draw pictures. And then you draw like a nice picture. Like, so you can fucking high road me.
Yeah, I guess
Yeah.
maybe that maybe it worked better for me because like I think I probably would have done that. I wouldn't have like instigated us drawing, but like I wouldn't be able to draw a character of a girl like where she looks goofy. I wouldn't.
No, but he clearly was his thing. Oh, and then,
That's oh
yeah.
God.
Sorry, it frustrates me. There's a line where they're like sitting watching TV, and she's like, "What are you?" I guess she like fell asleep. She's like, "What are you watching?" And he goes, "Oh, the best show. It's called Sophia." And it's like, "Oh my God, who wrote? What 14-year-old wrote this?" If I said that to a, can you imagine saying that to a woman, and it working?
Well, you have to be Tom Cruise and not have half a face, you know?
Yeah.
I think what's interesting, I kind of forgot that she is like half naked in this movie too.
Yes.
Is that he finds that like birthmark on her chest
Yeah.
and he's like, I could live here. And I know that that's basically like Chekhov's gun, where they're just basically setting it up so that like he can find that birthmark later,
Yeah.
you know. But there's something so much more intimate and realistic about that sequence where he's like talking about her birthmark versus all this other shit, you know, that
Right,
he's doing.
right. Well, that's a great sequence too, because like it does this really interesting thing where it's a montage of them like kind of making love, but also like just like cuddling and like having fun and just like rolling around in bed, whatever. But it keeps like the image keeps stopping and being still. So it gives you the feeling of like images and like how memories will stick in your have memories of good moments stick in your mind. But that's all made up. That's all his fantasy because he didn't, it's not like he knew her for years and then he had this fantasy. He knew her for like meeting her twice. And then his whole relationship is it's based on shit from his own brain. Like, how would he know how she would react in all these situations without making it up because he didn't really know her?
And going back to my Matrix thing, you know, we watched this back in the day and we're like, oh, there's no way we could kind of experience this sort of virtual reality where we could make a woman and stuff like that. But now in the present day, people do fucking like interact with virtual boyfriends and girlfriends. And they just, I mean, I literally just saw a fucking movie about it last night, Companion, where like it's a tailor-made person. And I actually did think about this movie at some point too, because it's the idea of like they're gonna react the way that you want them to react. And they're so it's so unnatural, but that's the way that technology works, right? Is that like you're able to do something unnatural. You're able to make this like beautiful person like think that you're amazing, even though they'd probably be kind of annoyed at you. They'd be like, oh, you're nice. You drew this picture of me. That's cool. You know, like we said before. Yeah.
I'm just looking at another line that's a really
Sure.
bad line.
Yeah.
The little things, there's nothing bigger.
Oh, God.
Oh, how
Oh,
deep.
yeah.
All right, let's since we've been talking forever, let's talk a little bit about the various theories. So, Cameron Crowe used to have a website back when people had websites, and it was called The Uncool, which is sort of based on something from what do you call it? Almost Famous.
Okay.
And he said on his website, in a very opposite of David Lynch thing, he said, here are the five different ways you could read the movie.
Yes.
And one is, I'm trying to find it. I had it written down. So one is the way that the movie presents itself, that it's exactly what it says, and then there's a split, and then the split happens when you think it happens, when they say it happens, and the rest is all a dream.
Yeah.
And then number two, everything up to the car wreck was real, and the rest of the entire film was all in David's head as he lies in a coma until the end he wakes up. So that's another way to read it, that it's all he's in a coma. The third way is the entire film is a dream as David struggles with his vanity, his sexual past, and his ideal women. The only real scene in the entire film would be the last where he wakes up. So that's another way to read it, that it's all a dream. Four, the movie is the writer, played by Jason Lee's fictional story about his friend, a story of the sour and the sweet, blah, blah. Okay. Five, the whole thing is a dream in that the depictions we see take place as reflections within a dream. However, the events are real, but it's kind of, where is it? Hold on, I lost it. However, the events are real until the splice at which they become fiction. Tech support states that David has been asleep 150 years. David's sessions seem to be reflections of his past. I think it's a fair interpretation that the reflections have been tampered with by the subconscious, meaning that everything that happens before the splice is real, but we're seeing like a dream version of it, which would explain why he hears Penelope Cruz's voice before he meets her.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I was gonna say, have you ever seen the Black Mirror episode San Junipero?
I don't know. I've only seen a handful of those. Which one is that?
That's the one where it's the girl and she's like in a virtual program, and it's kind of like where you go when you die, basically, or when you like retire. Like when you get very old, you go into this virtual reality and you're like young and youthful and stuff. You didn't see
I
that
think I
one?
might have seen that. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, there's a concept in that episode where people are just in this reality forever because their bodies have died or they've gotten very old, and so they're just in there forever. And so people have these like great romantic fantasies in this virtual reality world, but after being in there for so long, some people start to like do deviant things. There's like this club where people are like hurting each other and stuff because they're just like in this virtual reality world. They want to like feel things, right? And I think that this movie must have inspired that episode on some level, because the idea of like you're like living in this virtual reality paradise that's like based on your own wishes and what you want to do. It's so funny because you mentioned David Lynch, and I watched Mulholland Drive to review with Danny on the Lastercast, kind of right around the same time that I was watching this. And you could do a whole episode talking about Mulholland Drive and talking about this. You know, I don't know necessarily if either movie influenced either. And they even came out around the same time too. But Mulholland Drive is about a person living in a fantasy sequence and then like sort of the grim reality, right? And then in Mulholland Drive, because it's David Lynch, there's so many theories about things. And one of them is like, what's the actual real part? Is
Right.
it all a dream? Is it this? And for me, the way that I've always interpreted out of those five things that you just listed was that it's like the whole thing is a dream based on actual events, and a portion of it is just his virtual reality fantasy. But when we see sequences with like Penelope Cruz or even like him, like when he's driving with Jason Lee and
Yeah.
stuff, that's like a glorified thing that he remembers while he's in the virtual reality. You know what I'm
Right, because
saying?
he's telling it as a story to Kurt Russell's character.
Right, right,
Right,
right.
right. Okay, so I think that's the one that makes the most sense. By the way, he has a ringtone that's Row 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 Your Boat, which
Oh.
is so fucking stupid because in Row 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 Your Boat they say life is but a dream. Get it?
Yeah.
Do you
Y
fucking get it?
well, they were saying that like the license plate shows that it's a dream. The license plate in this car, because it has like the 30th day of the
The
of
registration
February.
sticker.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I
right.
mean,
It has a date that doesn't exist.
yeah.
Fuck
No,
off.
I'm
Yeah.
yeah, I feel like this episode is just me kind of doing these long rants about like the Matrix and reality and stuff, and then you're like, yeah, and Tom Cruise does this annoying thing over here, and then Tom Cruise does, that's like the majority of this episode.
No, no, I think it's interesting to compare it to Mulholland Drive. But I also at the time compared it a lot to Eyes Wide Shut because it's one is Eyes Wide Shut, one is Open Your Eyes, and they're both kind of like dreams. Eyes Wide Shut isn't virtual reality, but it's the whole thing is meant to kind of be like a dream. And they both have Tom Cruise as like wealthy, privileged person. It's interesting to read this movie through that. But also I think it is interesting to read it through Mulholland Drive because the reality is scarier. Like the reality that you're not dealing with is something very scary, which is this movie doesn't get there.
No.
The last, by the way, the last interpretation, which I think is very stupid,
Okay.
is that it's like all these Christian metaphors that
Oh boy.
because he committed suicide, he's going to hell, I guess, and both women who work for LE, the life extension company, have red hair.
Oh.
So they're like devil ladies or whatever. I don't know, man.
Yes. No. Fuck that interpretation.
I
You
know, it's so
know.
stupid.
Yeah. But we should talk about the ending itself and how he gets out, right? Because that always had a tremendous impact on me. I think more than anything else, there's the sequence where they're playing a song by Sigur Rós, and it's like when he is thinking about his life that happened, he's talking to the tech support guy, and he's talking about what actually happened in reality. That song is so dreamy unto itself. And you have Tilda Swinton, which I think this is maybe the first time I ever saw Tilda Swinton in anything, and she has this brief kind of moment, but it's like so magical when he's in a building, and then we go up to this roof, and like special effects were more exciting for us back then in 2001, and for that shot where he like runs to the edge of the roof, and then the camera goes over his shoulder and like looks down at the city. That's really well done, and it gives you that sense of vertigo, you know?
But I also like that the sky is like the Monet sky. So
Yes.
like it doesn't necessarily in that moment have to look realistic.
Right.
Because also like the every he's in that moment he's very aware that he's in a reality and he's given this choice to either reset the reality, or to go and choose life. And they say he's been frozen for 150 years, so it's possible that he's re that in the past he's just reset it a bunch of times, and it keeps going bad because of his guilt about Cameron Diaz.
Yeah.
Although I don't think the film itself deals with that enough. Yeah, I've always been intrigued by the part where so they say that because he didn't have a good relationship with his dad. He bases the psychologist character that Kurt Russell plays on Atticus Finch
Yeah.
from To
To
Kill a
Kill a Mockingbird.
Mockingbird, the Gregory Peck version. And there's a really intriguing part where he's like, David, don't believe them. This is the board. This is the seven dwarves. He calls the board of directors that have control of life the seven dwarves. There's also that like weird subplot of like maybe it's all corporate espionage or whatever.
Right.
The tech support guy's like, and he's like, he's not real. Don't feel bad for him, David. And he's like, I'm real. And he's like, I have two daughters. And then the tech support guy's like, what are your daughters' names? And he can't think of their names.
Yeah.
I find that intriguing, or I. Yeah, I find it intriguing. I found it more intriguing when I was younger. Now I think it's a little stupid.
It is because
But is it just right?
Kurt Russell has this one line that's so cheesy where he's like, emotional support, reality,
The
or
mortality for home entertainment.
right. He's like, what a shitty future. He says something like that,
Yeah,
right?
yeah,
And
yeah.
yeah, it's so corny, but it's because Kurt Russell says it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
No, but his reaction when he's like, oh, I'm real, I'm real.
Yeah.
It's funny, but it's also, I don't know. What the problem with movies that are virtual reality or it's a dream is that you'll see certain things, like you'll see the scenes with him and Kurt Russell, and you'll be like, well, does this really kind of matter, you know, at
Yeah,
all?
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
No, I
you
agree.
know, and so, I mean, it just, thank God he's played by Kurt Russell, which makes it just more interesting just by default,
Yeah.
you know. But no, it's that's a very Black Mirror kind of concept of like a character that's created in your virtual reality kind of having this existential crisis
Yeah, right.
at the
That's
very
what's
end.
interesting about it, I guess.
Yeah,
Like,
yeah.
'cause like if you were an actor, you got to think like how if you were acting that, how would you even approach that? Like thinking that you have a daughter and then realizing you don't know their names and then realizing you're not real.
Yeah.
Like that's a crazy thing for an actor to try to do.
Right. And I think you know, one last thing we kind of talk about too is just like the music choices. There's musical cues too that kind of hit you on the head. You realize it after you see it two times, you know, but like there's What If God Was One of Us,
Good
where like
Vibrations by Beach Boys.
that's actually an excellent sequence when Good Vibrations kicks in,
Yeah.
because Good Vibrations has this like really kind of crazy part to it.
Yeah,
And
yeah, yeah.
they sync it up with what's going on in the movie just right, you know, where he's like, it's a madhouse. Yeah.
I know, but it's also like so on the nose.
Right. Yes, exactly. What if God was one of us and he's like the God of the virtual reality? Yes.
Yeah, I know. I know. Damn. But yeah, so when he does decide that he's gonna jump off the roof and come to life, again, when I was a kid, I thought this was so beautiful. Like he sees the Sophia again, and he
Yeah.
like apologizes to her, and his face turns normal in that moment, and she says, "I'll find you again," which again, when I was 18, was like how romantic. But it's like
Yeah.
number one. What are you saying in that moment that there's like a such thing as souls and soulmates and she'll be reincarnated? Like, what does that mean? Or they'll meet together in heaven? Also, like you didn't know him, and also this isn't the real her talking. So
Right. Right.
why, you know, now I'm like, why are we making such a big moment out of this moment? But when
Yeah.
I was a kid, I was like, ah, oh, it's so beautiful.
Right. And see, that is something that I look back with like great shame on, because I had that exact thought as well. And I think that this is a problem with our culture in general. And I think it is actually because of movies like this and movies in general. There's this concept for men, and I think that this probably happens with like incel men a lot too,
Yeah.
is that the idea is that if we love a woman intensely enough, if we truly love a woman, then she's meant to be with us.
Yes, it's a very dangerous idea.
Exactly. And this movie, I think it flirts with that idea. It shows parts. I think like the idea of like him killing Penelope Cruz, you know, and thinking that she's Cameron Diaz, that gives you that kind of feeling of the danger of this fantasy. But it is something that we, from watching movies and stuff, it's like, well, it doesn't matter if like you and the woman don't get along at first. If you're persistent, they'll like you.
Yes,
It doesn't
yeah.
matter if like she's with someone else, or like if your lives don't match up. If you really love this woman, you're gonna find a way to be together.
Yeah, I mean, that's also going back to Cameron Crowe. That's something that people criticize Say Anything for. Like the famous moment of him outside her window with In Your Eyes playing on the boombox. That's a moment in the film where she's broken up with him, but he's
Yep.
so in love with her, he's gonna like, that's like stalking
Yep.
what that is. Like,
Right.
to say you how your feelings are so big that they are more important than her rights or her consent
Yeah.
is not right.
Right. I mean, that's one of the core things of this movie, and I think the core thing of our conversation here today is the idea of like my emotions will control reality. My emotions will
Yeah.
affect reality. I feel this way about a person. Reality is going to make it work.
Yeah. It's almost like the movie's perfect for 18-year-olds.
You know me from around when I was like 18, 19, 20. And I only had like one really serious girlfriend at that time, and I was like obsessed with her, you know? And boy, was this movie like fucking, you know, I was just eating that shit up.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Yeah. And
And now I'm 42 and I'm looking back at Tom Cruise like just like, oh, you dick, you
yeah.
know, like just take some of that
Yeah.
money and do something worthwhile with it, you pretentious asshole.
Yeah, I know. Like when you're young, I think you, because you have these big emotional feelings and these big like desire, you feel like love, like big love must feel big. But as adults, like we've both been in relationships a long time, like to me, real love is not exciting. And I don't mean
Yeah.
exciting like in a, I don't mean that like in a bad way. I mean like real love doesn't set you on fire. Like real
Right.
love is comfortable. Real love is like having a like a real relationship with somebody where you're not, you know, it doesn't drive you crazy. Like that's an 18-year-old's idea of real love.
Right.
Like real
Exactly.
love is stability and comfort and being family with somebody and truly knowing somebody.
Right. And like seeing each other at sort of like embarrassing moments or low moments and not being turned off by them, but just like feeling empathy for them.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's nothing like that in this movie whatsoever. I
No,
mean, the quote.
this movie makes you think that real, like, if you find true love, you're just constantly flirting. You're constantly quipping at each other.
The closest thing you get to it is the fact that Penelope Cruz has compassion for him when he has his disfigurement. And there is this really great sequence where he meets her in the ballet class or whatever,
Yeah.
and she like looks at his face and like you can see in her face that like she's not like, oh, you're so handsome and beautiful. I mean, not, first of all, she wouldn't say that. But like, I don't care about your disfigurement. You know, I still love who you are. There's not that. It's like she actually is unsettled by what she sees,
Yeah.
but she tries not to like show it. And I think that's really good acting on her part.
Yes.
You know.
So as we come to the end here, have we figured it out? Is this a good movie or a bad movie?
I wouldn't say it's bad. I would say that there's quite a few parts that sort of make you cringe
Yeah.
watching it. But I would say that there is enough visual imagery and just unique stuff to where I think it's worthy of watching.
Okay, I agree. I think it's very well, on a technical level, it's very well made.
Yes.
And it's beautiful to look at. And I do feel like I just said, like for a young person, it's probably they get a lot out of it.
Yeah.
I guess my only thing, if I would give the movie more grace if it treated Cameron Diaz's character with more respect.
Yeah.
Like there's a scene where he like has a dream where Cameron Diaz is there and she's like boo, and it's like a jump scare, and it's like she's not the Riddler, she's a fucking, you know what I mean? Like they treat her like
Yes.
the, like she's not a villain, she's the fucking, you
Right. And
know.
I think that that just kind of happens for plot reasons. I think they make her a villain just so that there's tension in the movie and stuff. Because when you watch this movie, often there's times where you're like, well, where is this going? Like, what is the, you know, movies often, it's like, it's very clear. This is the problem. The guy has to overcome this. But this movie, you kind of don't understand what's going on in a few sequences. And the jumping around in time makes it not seem like there's like a ticking clock. And so I
Right.
think that they vilify Cameron Diaz just so that there's this like tension or there's like something that Tom Cruise has to worry about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I'll say it's a good movie.
Okay. All right. All right. Nice. Yeah.
All right, is there anything else you want to say about Vanilla Sky?
No, I mean, I know that we kind of ragged on it, but I actually was like very excited to go back and watch it again.
Me
So.
too. It was definitely an important movie to me at a certain time in my life.
I could say the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was when we first started hanging out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many moons ago.
Yeah. Now look at us.
I know. So what's going on in your channels? Anything new and exciting?
Well, Danny and I, at the time of this recording, it's like the beginning of February. February's starting now. We're about to record our top 10 horror movies of 2024.
Okay.
So, there's a lot of great things in 2024. Like I said a couple times in this video or this discussion, I just saw the movie Companion. We'll probably cover that on the
Nice,
channel.
nice.
I think as far as that goes with the last guest. And then comic books transform, there's a lot of comic book stuff coming up. There's like, the new Captain America movie coming like around Valentine's Day, so we'll
Are
cover
you
that
excited
too.
about that?
Not really, no.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marvel is really, yeah. I don't know.
No,
Anyway.
it's like, I think that like me and Brian, we could get a good conversation going no matter what. It's just like, it starts to become a chore with Marvel and some of these
You bet
franchises.
it is. You bet it is.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for being here. This has been PCMC. We come out every single week. Peter Marsh, you could check him out on his YouTube channels, The LasserCast and Comic Books Transformed. Peter, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you. I mean, it was not a chore talking about Vanilla Sky with you.
Thank you very much. It was not.
Go
We end every episode by saying,
bye-bye.